Good morning, everyone, and go ahead and please have a seat. So, my name is Justin. I'm not one of the pastors here at Higher Hope. I'm not on the staff at Higher Hope. I have served Higher Hope in a number of capacities over the year, and currently I'm serving as one of your elders. I'm kind of like the substitute teacher. Every once in a while, there's an opening in the message series, and Pastor Mike will let me jump in and take a message. And you know, being the substitute teacher, Mike always has to wonder, you know, what kind of mess is he's going to come back to. Sometimes it's the message, and sometimes it's you guys. And the great thing is this is first service, so it's 50-50 at this point. So, over the years, I've had the opportunity to share a message a number of times, and I will be honest with you, the public speaking side of it isn't the side of it that keeps me up at night or stresses me. I've been fortunate to have a number of jobs in my life where I did a lot of public speaking very early. The difficulty for me, the weight, the stress, comes from sharing a message. And there's a fear that weighs on me that I will say something wrong or I will say something and someone will take it in a manner that I didn't necessarily mean. And they'll make a decision, a spiritual decision that doesn't lead them in the right direction. The other thing is that I also fear that because I'm here and I am sharing a message, that you'll see me for something that I'm not. You'll see me as being less sinful or being closer to God, and let me tell you, that's the furthest thing from the truth. I'm a sinner. Anyone that knows me knows that I can get angry, I can hold a grudge. My wife and kids will tell you that at times I can be overbearing and I don't let things go. And there are situations that get the best of me and I don't say things or act in a way that puts Christians in the best light. So I am no better than anyone else in here. As we got ready, or Pastor Mike came to me and asked me to give this message, something funny always happens when you're giving a message. See, you get an idea, you get a concept for a message, and then God puts something in your life that hits you and kind of says, yeah, that's a good message, but you really need to learn that lesson. And that happened a couple weeks ago. I snuck out of work a little early on a Friday. We had some family coming in town. It was the first time in a number of years that myself and my three brothers had been together. It's also going to be probably the last time that we all get together for quite a while. My brother's getting deployed to South Korea. So I wanted to get home. I wanted to get the lawn mowed. I wanted to weed whack. I had all of these things that I wanted to do. And I walk in the house, and my wife says to me, I have some great news, which is the sign that the news that she's about to give me is not good news. We had a water leak. So in our closet, you could reach up and back in, you know, between the first floor and the second floor, water was just spraying everywhere. So we're trying to figure it out. I get up there and you really can't reach in to get it. And on one side of the wall is the kitchen, on the other side is our bathroom. And well, we started discussing how the best way to get to the water leak. You know, are we going to cut a hole in the ceiling in our bathroom? Or are we going to, you know, pull the cabinets off the wall and reach up in? And where are the joists? Because if you can't quite get to it, then, you know, you might have a hole in both rooms, and we really don't want that. So needless to say, that discussion quickly became a debate, which quickly became, let's just say, tensions were high in the Thomas household that afternoon. And because my wife isn't in here, I can tell you that I won that debate. I won that discussion. And we cut a hole in the ceiling in our bathroom, and I didn't have to tear cabinets off the wall and the whole nine yards. So get up there, get it out. It's leaking from an elbow. Nice, easy fix. I'm going to run to Home Depot and get the parts, be back, and I'll fix it. It'll all be good. So this part is probably going to scare a couple people in this room because you know what I do every day. But after my fourth trip to Home Depot, I'm leaving Home Depot. It's a hot day. I'm sweaty. I'm irritated because I have a list of things that I need to get done for tomorrow, and I won't have time in the morning to do it. And I'm driving down that access road between, you know, Home Depot and Walmart and Painted Post. And ahead of me on the right, I can see a gentleman standing in the grass by the sidewalk. And I'm watching him because, you know, traffic's backed up. And he's got on this brilliant white T-shirt. You know, like the white that it just came out of the package. And the minute that you put it on or the minute you wash it, it goes away. It's got that iridescent shine to it almost. He's got a hat and sunglasses and, you know, a nice tan and your brand new Nike sneakers, that same glow to it, and he's holding a sign. And as I get closer, the sign says, "We'll work for food." So my first thought wasn't, "Hey, I have a cup holder full of change." It wasn't, "On my third trip to Home Depot, I stopped at the Dandy and got, you know, two Mountain Dews because they're 2 for $3.33, and I don't need the second one, but the deal is 2 for $3.33. My thought wasn't, "Maybe he's a plumber, and for a pizza, I can get this water leak fixed," or "Maybe he was a landscaper, and he can do a great job mowing my lawn." No, it was none of those. It was, "Dude, you're holding a whiteboard panhandling? Come on, at least look the part, right? You know, don't wear the brand new white T-shirt and the white brand new Nikes." And who panhandles with a whiteboard? I mean, it wasn't like a crunched up piece of paper or a cardboard box. This was a whiteboard. There's not a whole lot about that story that's real Christian, right? And so, as I was preparing for this message, that happened, and it kind of smacks you in the face. So my "I want to be like" is the Good Samaritan. So we're going to be in Luke chapter 10, verse 25. As you turn there in your Bibles, I want to point out something that I came across as I was getting ready for this message, is that Christ largely tells two types of parables. He tells a parable about the convicted receiving grace. We all really, really like that story because we can all see ourselves as the convicted, and there's this greatness, this blessing that comes upon us when we receive that grace, that our sins are washed away, and it's a good, heartwarming story. The second parable that Christ largely tells is where we are convicted to receive grace, or to give grace. And that one's a little bit tougher for us to stomach because it causes us to look inside ourselves. It causes us to examine our heart and to really examine where we are sharing grace and where we are not sharing grace. So I'll give you a little bit of context here. Actually, I'll just dive right in. On one occasion, the expert in the law stood up to test Jesus. "Teacher," he asked, "what must I do to inherit eternal life?" So right away, we know this is a religious lawyer. He's well-versed in, you know, religious law. He knows he's setting Jesus up. He's trying to trap him. The priests and the other religious lawyers don't really like what Jesus is doing. They don't like the message that he's sharing. So, you know, I kind of picture them like in this back room, and they're like, "How are we going to get this guy?" And this one lawyer stands up in the back and says, "I got the perfect question for him." And Jesus says in verse 26, "What is written in the law?" He replied, "How do you read it?" So like any good pastor, he answers the question with another question. He knows that religious lawyer knows the answer, and he's saying, "No, this isn't going to be on me. I want to examine your heart. I want to examine what you know. Do you truly understand the law?" And the religious lawyer answered, "Love the Lord your God with all of your heart and with all of your soul and with all of your strength and with all of your mind, and love your neighbors as yourself." Perfect answer, right? I mean, that is the textbook answer. So Jesus replies, You have answered correctly. Do this and you will live. And I think that it kind of gets lost a little bit in translation, but do this and you will live. He doesn't say do this sometimes, do it most of the time. He says do this. He's calling out the religious lawyer saying, you're right, but you have to do it every single moment of every single day for the entirety of your life. Think about what that means. Think about when the people down the road get a new car or a swimming pool, and you're like, I want that. Think about the folks at work that drive you crazy and they grate on you and you get frustrated and angry. Think about how tough. It's an impossible task. And Jesus was pointing that out, that, hey, look, in order to achieve eternal life by that standard, you have to live by that standard for every moment of every day. So that kind of struck at the heart of this religious lawyer, and he's like, oh man, I just got called out on this. And he's looking for that technicality to get him out. So he asks, or he wanted to justify himself. So in verse 29, he says, and he asked Jesus, who is my neighbor? In his mind, he's like, the neighbor is the guy that lives next door to me, that I get along with. It's the priest at the synagogue. It's not the guy down the street that plays the music too loud, or, you know, his kids are up late, or his dog's always barking. That's not my neighbor. He's trying to find, you know, that inch of space in the law that he can operate in. In verse 30, Jesus says, a man was going down from Jerusalem to Jericho when he was attacked by a bunch of robbers. They stripped him of his clothing, beat him, and went away, leaving him half dead. So let me explain to you a little bit about, give you some context about the road to Jericho. So from Jerusalem to Jericho, it's roughly 17 miles. And you descend about 3,000 feet from Jerusalem to Jericho. It was often referred to as the Blood Road because so many robbers and bandits attacked people on this road. It wasn't I-86 that runs through here. It was a winding, mountainous, ravines on both sides kind of road. And actually at one section, there were some large boulders and some crevices in the sheer cliffs around it that became known as the Blood Gate, because robbers would hide around that Blood Gate and they would attack, rob, leave people for death. So this man is taking his life in his hands as he goes down this road. And in verse 30, we hear a priest happened to be going down the same road. And when he saw the man, he passed by on the other side. So here he is, the priest is traveling down this road, sees this man on this dangerous road, lying near death, and the priest just passed by. Now, I suppose that in the priest's mind, he was justifying himself by saying that, you know, he had been purified and he was quote-unquote clean, and if he touched that man, he would be unclean, and when he got to Jericho or he got to a synagogue, he wouldn't be able to perform the duties of a priest. I mean, it sounds reasonable, right? It's justifiable, I guess, to the priest. So we continue. So too, a Levite, when he came to the place and saw the man, passed by him on the other side of the road. So a Levite he's not a priest, but he's in the religious order. He's kind of that next rung down. They had a lot of things to do in the temple to support the priest. And he just kind of sees him, and he walks to the other side of the road, and he's like, I'm not getting involved in that mess. It's just not my thing, you know. I'm in a hurry. I don't want to be caught on this road because, I mean, if people attack that man, they're likely still in the area, so I may or may not be attacked. It's kind of a justifiable excuse, I guess. But then, in verse 33, we come to the Samaritan. But a Samaritan, as he traveled, came where the man was, and when he saw him, he took pity on him. He went to him and bandaged his wounds, pouring on oil and wine. Then he put the man on his own donkey, brought him to an inn, and took care of him. So a Samaritan. So originally there was one kingdom of Israel. It was split in half by the Assyrians. They came in and took over the northern half of the country. And the Samaritans were the children or the offspring of the Assyrians and Jews. And they were hated. They were despised. They were not viewed as being human. You can find some religious texts or some texts from the time that explain that Jews looked down on Samaritans to the point where you would rather eat pig or pork than a loaf of bread made by a Samaritan. And there, at this point in history, there was no Jewish individual that would have touched pork, but the food made by the bread made by a Samaritan was considered worse. So think about that. From here's Jesus in the middle of this room or this area explaining to religious leaders that this Samaritan who was walking down the same road as a priest and as a Levite stopped and took care of this man. Think about the perils that we discussed. It's a blood road, robbers. He's likely they're in the area. And he takes the tools that he had purposely packed for himself to ensure whatever journey he was on, he could handle whatever came up. He took his wine and his oil that would have been used as antiseptics and to treat injuries and used it on this man. He didn't know him. He took some of his clothes and at least tore them so that he could bandage him. Or if he had additional clothing, he would have given it to this man. But he doesn't stop there. It goes on. The next day he took out 2 denarii and gave them to the innkeeper. Look after him, he said, and when I return, I will reimburse you for any extra expense you may have. He didn't find this man on the side of the road, take him to a hospital, and drop him off at the ER and be like, I'm done. He took him to the nearest inn. He stayed with him for 2 days. Took care of him. Delayed his own travel. And if he was going down the road from Jerusalem to Jericho, he was on a mission. It wasn't like a joyride. This wasn't vacation where he had time to spare. And on his way out, he takes 2 denarii. And gives it to the innkeeper for any expenses that he may incur. So archaeologists have found a kind of like a placard or a board from roughly the same time period for an inn. And one night at an inn was roughly 1/32 of a denarii. The Good Samaritan paid for 64 nights in a hotel. That would be like any of us in here roughly finding someone on the side of the road, taking them to a hotel, and as we walk out, we give the hotel somewhere around $8,000 for 64 days, for 2 whole months. And then on top of it, he says, and I want you to take care of him. And if you incur any expense on my way back through, I'll pay for it. I'm good for it. I'll take care of it. Think about that. Think if we found someone, we take them to the hospital, we drop them off, we pay for 64 days in a hospital, and then we say, and whatever treatment he needs, get him the treatment and send me the bill. That like doesn't compute in our world. That is so mind-blowing, so out of this world that none of us can really even comprehend what it would be like to do that. But that's kind of the standard that Christ has laid out. He's indicted the religious establishment of the time and said, hey, listen, you guys are good, but you guys are not living the right life. This good Samaritan has picked up the mantle, has poured out grace that you can't even begin to fathom. In verse 36, it says, which of these three do you think was the neighbor to the man who fell into the hands of the robber? Christ is saying, I'm not going to answer this question. You need to answer this question. How will you? He's letting them indict themselves. In verse 37, the expert of the law replied, the one who had mercy on him. Christ says, Jesus told him, go and do likewise. He indicted the entire religious establishment. And he sets this standard. This isn't, hey, pick someone up at or on the side of the road. This isn't, you know, when the guy's panhandling will work for food. According to that standard, I should have taken the guy home. I should have invited him to the family reunion or the party the next day. And I should have fed him until he found stability. He found his way to his feet. Are we a culture, are we people that pour out grace abundantly? I think for a lot of people, you know, grace is, you know, putting change in the red kettle or, you know, the Salvation Army at Christmas time, or it's volunteering or serving at a food bank. And don't get me wrong, those things are great and we must do those things. But we must also pour out grace abundantly, without regard for our time or our money. Kind of in closing, I'd like to introduce you to a lady. Her name is Yasmin Green, and I think we have a picture of her. Miss Green was born in 1959. She was born in Jamaica. She was the oldest of 12 children. By the time she turned 20, both of her parents had passed away, and she was responsible for her 11 younger siblings. Throughout her life, she owned her own dress store. Some articles that I have read about her said that she owned her own fresh fish market, which is kind of ahead of the time if you really think about it. Organic wasn't a real big thing back then. In the late 90s, she immigrated from Jamaica to New York City. She worked. She had a bunch of odd jobs. She lived in an apartment that the church owned. And the people that know her or knew her talk about how every bit of money that she made, she gave back to her children. She sent the money home. At Christmas time, she would send gifts. When she saved up enough money, she would fill barrels full of food and send them back to her 6 children in Jamaica. Unfortunately, it all wasn't good for Miss Green. She suffered from depression, from some mental illness, and at different points in her life, it affected her greatly. There's some stories that she would pace the block that she lived on, you know, crying that her soul was killing her or her soul needed healing. Sometimes her roommates would come home and they'd find all of their stuff out on the curb, and she was cleansing and trying to clear her soul, and you know, the church would come in and, you know, pick up the things and bring them back to the apartment, and they would kind of smooth things out, and you know, she spent some time you know, trying to really work on herself. But on June 15th of 2008, she was suffering from one of these episodes, and she found herself banging on her pastor's door, you know, crying that her soul needed healing. And the pastor came out and, you know, talked with her, invited her in, and, you know, they prayed together, and over a course of several hours, he tried to work with her and to get her kind of even and stable so that, you know, she could go home. And he realized very quickly that this was not one of those times where he was equipped to really take care of her. So at some point in the early morning hours of the following day, he called 911. The police and the EMS showed up, and they, you know, took her to King's Hospital in Brooklyn. And here in a second, we're going to show you a video. I do want to warn you that the video is not graphic, but it is disturbing. Miss Green died that morning. She had been in that hospital for 24 hours, sitting in that waiting room in a urine-soaked hospital gown. She fell to the floor, and no less than three hospital employees looked in on her and did nothing. That doesn't include the patients that were in the waiting room. Miss Green went to the very place that was specifically built to save her and died. I want to ask you this question. What if her soul was killing her? And what if, rather than a hospital, she was in a church? I think each and every one of us would demand justice for her. Should we charge those hospital workers with murder because they did nothing and she passed away? Is that just manslaughter? Should they be charged with neglect? But what if someone was in this building, spiritually dying, and we did nothing? Should we be held accountable for spiritual murder? Should we be held accountable for spiritual manslaughter or neglect? the hard truth, folks, is that has happened here. Someone in the last 13 years has come into this building or into our congregation struggling, spiritually dying, and we have done nothing. Everyone shook hands with someone this morning, and I would be willing to bet that there is someone in this service this day, this time, right now, that is spiritually struggling, and we shook their hands. What obligation, what commitment should we have to them? Are we going to pour out grace abundantly? Or are we going to pass by like the priest and the Levite, avoiding the mess, not wanting to get unclean? It's something that we all have to look at within ourselves and look at who we are and where we're at and what obligation that we have to those not only in this building but the people in our lives, the people at work, the people at the soccer fields or the baseball fields that we have in our circle. At this time, I'm going to ask the worship team to come back up. Donna's going to be up at the crossover on this side, and Pastor John's going to be at the cross on this side. And I'm begging you, if you're struggling, if your soul needs healing and prayer, and you're comfortable, I know it's a huge step, but they're going to be up here at the crosses just to pray with you.
You're the God of this city, you're the King of these people, you're the Lord of this nation, you are. You're the light in this darkness, you're the hope to the homeless, you're the peace to the restless, you are. You're the God of this city.